Chapter 2. The Intellectual Awakening of the Navy. A Republic of Ideas. Two factors dramatically changed the ability of officers to disseminate their ideas publicly by the 1830s, both based on the wave of American democratization, cost and education. In the 1830s, the price of newspapers declined from 6 cents to a penny. Books that sold in 1830 for $2 were only 25 cents a decade later. As a result of the dramatic price decrease, newspapers, books, and journals became more affordable to the general population, and the number of publications rose during Jackson's presidency. The second factor was the impact of the common schools on literacy rates. The medium of print and the ability of more Americans to read meant that writers, and specifically naval officers, could reach a wide audience for the first time. Lieutenant Charles Wilkes requested the purchase of a lithographic press for the Navy in 1833 for each Navy yard. He estimated that the Navy would save money from rollers, ink, and printer labor. Moreover, since the Navy had to buy French and British charts, it could make its own and correct them immediately. American scientific journals made their advent in the post-war period in the 1830s and included articles related to naval issues. The American Journal of Science, founded in 1817 by Yale University chemistry professor Benjamin Silliman, includes articles of the safety of steamboats and studies on the various bodies of water the Navy was exploring. The increase of Navy-related articles in the 1830s was primarily due to the growing use of steamboats and their application for the Navy. Other articles discussed potential explorations. The increased interest in the Navy may also be a result of Silliman, who on at least one occasion visited the Naval Lyceum in 1834 with Lieutenant James Glynn. 4 years later, Glynn served with the South Seas Exploring Expedition. These and the literary and scientific journals like them were an integral component of advancing the Navy's learning and, in turn, of the broader academic, literary, and generally American audiences in the 1830s. They shared a common goal with the Navy's junior officers, to share ideas and information in a new era of advancing thought and exploration. The new generation of officers in the 1830s led an intellectual reformation through concepts articulated in publications and organizations. They challenged conventional thinking in the Navy and confronted their own superiors in print, albeit through their relatively anonymity of pseudonyms. Their ideas set the Navy on its eventual path of professionalism. They became the ship captains and commodores who later commanded the ships and squadrons of the Mexican-American War and Civil War. One British historian writes that the Enlightenment's direct impact on the navies of the day, as opposed to its indirect, long-term influence on the societies which sustain them, seems in truth to have been rather limited. While that may have been true of European navies, it was not applicable to the U.S. Navy. During Jackson's presidency, the Navy experienced its own age of enlightenment. Intellectually curious junior officers, along with like-minded and supportive literary figures, were learning about the world, a world that was only beginning to realize the nation's potential as a future power. The young republic's naval operations stimulated their curiosity. The Navy, from its establishment in 1798 through 1815, experienced three wars, and its officers and secretaries of the Navy could do little more than react to short-term threats and objectives. The post-war environment at first brought breathing room for the Navy, and, as it built up its fleet beginning in 1816, it finally had the opportunity to think about the world and its emerging role. The environment created by the post-war of 1812 pause in war fighting enabled the junior officers sufficient time, resources, and opportunities to develop a robust correspondence network about naval policies and innovative ideas. Naval officers shared their experiences with one another and collectively stimulated their knowledge and views. They articulated their thoughts through new publications, in reviewing Lieutenant Matthew Murray's Treatise on Navigation, editor Edgar Allan Poe observed, "The spirit of literary improvement has been awakened among the officers of our gallant Navy. Hitherto, how little have they improved the golden opportunity of knowledge, which their distant voyages held forth, and how little have they enjoyed the rich banquet which nature spreads for them in every clime they visit. But the time is coming when, imbued with a taste for science and spirit of research, they will become ardent explorers of the regions in which they sojourn." This was the first period of robust published naval thought in the United States. New technologies emerged, and new lands were explored. The Navy debated and developed new, better-structured schools. Conceptual changes to the Navy would not have been possible without appropriate and effective dissemination within and beyond the Navy. During the age of Jackson, this dissemination included unofficial correspondence between officers, articles in new professional journals, like-minded popular literary figures, education to sow the seeds of learning, and organizations whose role was to share ideas among a commonly interested population. This was the Navy's version of the French Enlightenment philosopher Peter Bayle's 1647-1706 concept of a republic of letters in which intellectuals corresponded with each other from great distances and shared ideas and discussed them in academics and salons. Prior to the age of Jackson, sharing news and information was difficult at best. From the establishment of the Department of the Navy in 1798 through the end of the War of 1812, the Navy's size was inconsistent, its role was ad hoc, and for most of the period it suffered from the instability caused by perpetual war, either with France, the Barbary States, or England. Beginning in the post-war period, ships, like the new ships of the line, on longer overseas deployments, meant that the Navy's midshipmen would become more familiar with one another as a group, rather than isolated in smaller ships dispersed throughout the eastern seaboard and deployed. In such close quarters, long-term deployments offered the next generation of midshipmen aboard frigates and ships of the line the opportunity to form professional and personal relationships. These relationships also included the growth of American-born literary figures whose uniquely American work, such as James Fenimore Cooper's Last of the Mohicans, appeared in the 1820s and 1830s. This new cadre of authors possessed close ties to the nascent Navy. Some, like Cooper, had served as midshipmen prior to the War of 1812, while others had brothers in the service. Authors like Washington Irving found themselves exposed to the Navy when they wrote about its adventures in the War of 1812 in journals and newspapers. In the 1830s, these same authors wrote fictional tales of the sea, as well as nonfiction works. Their popular works reached a hungry American audience beyond what the officers themselves could accomplish. The combination of internally generated ideas among naval officers, their dissemination in professional organizations, and the popular interest they generated led to exploration, such as the South Seas Exploring Expedition, and education with the establishment in 1845 of a naval school. Better educated than the preceding generation of naval officers, these lieutenants and midshipmen immersed themselves in the culture, history, and geography of foreign ports. They witnessed the instability of other governments. As they grew, their ideas took seed and formed the basis of a new outlook for themselves as professional officers, for the Navy, and for the country as a whole. The first exposure of many midshipmen to the world was through books. The first ship's library was on the ship of the line Franklin, which left the United States in 1817 for a 3-year Mediterranean deployment. Its library included volumes purchased by Commodore Charles Stewart and a charitable mariner's society. In 1828, Secretary of the Navy Southard issued a circular for all ships to have a library with 37 specific books, including those on trigonometry, algebra, gunnery, histories of Greece, Rome, and England, the laws of nations, and maritime laws, among others. Correspondence, journals, and diaries in later years often provided the officers an opportunity to reflect on each of their ships, the men who commanded them, and the men who served aboard. Writing to a fellow officer in 1835 and reflecting on his service on a ship just 2 years prior, Lieutenant Samuel Francis DuPont noted, "I have always looked upon my cruise in the USS Ontario as the brightest period of my professional life. It was performed after the thoughtlessness of youth had fortunately yielded a little to the stability of manhood." By the time of his service aboard Ontario, DuPont had been in the Navy for 16 years with several overseas deployments. The topics of the officers' correspondence varied during the age of Jackson, with the location of their friends of primary concern. But the correspondence was not simply idle chatter. Many thoughts or questions, particularly as they involved what other officers might encounter, expanded their awareness of the Navy and the world around them. Echoing McKay's observation, Lieutenant Garrett J. Pendergrast was concerned about the disease's impact on the other officers of the squadron operating in the sometimes unforgiving climate. Pendergrast thought that DuPont had been numbered with these gallant fellows who have sacrificed themselves for their ungrateful country's good. Relationships were integral to forming later correspondence. Later, Rear Admiral Benjamin F. Sands recalled meeting Midshipman Joshua Sands on their first ship in 1828. "We used to while away many hours endeavoring to trace out a relationship." News of courts-martial also reached across the fleet, albeit slowly. In May 1829, Lieutenant Daniel McKay awaited news of one trial involving Lieutenant Irving Shubrick. Shubrick had brought Marine Lieutenant Joseph Hale of the Java on charges of quarreling and scandalous conduct, including a challenge to personal combat. Found guilty, Hale received a sentence of suspension for 12 months. That the trial occurred in the Mediterranean meant that it could be weeks to months before the other officers learned of the results. In McKay's case, it is unlikely he learned of it while in the Gulf of Mexico before the loss of the Hornet. But that did not prevent him from rendering a judgment. "I take the Marine will be taught a lesson." The officers of that corps seem fated to bring about their own destruction and that of the corps. They are idle and, of course, doing mischief. Deployments around the globe allowed officers the opportunity to compare notes about the differences of each port, country, and region, and the challenges each offered. This, of course, also included interactions with characters. DuPont, for example, met with Edward John Trelawney at Napoli di Romania, then the capital of the Greeks, at the head of the Gulf of Argos in September 1825. Trelawney had, the year prior, accompanied Lord Byron to Greece during its war for independence. Surgeon's mate, John Wiley, in 1831, wrote of the novel and beautiful appearance of Constantinople, and admired everything from the minarets to the white buildings of Lesotho Point in a grove of cypresses. "If I had but one city to see, that city would be Constantinople. European cities always have something in common. Here, everything is distinct and peculiar." For Chaplain Thomas Lambert, awe of regions manifested itself in the frigate United States' visit to the Holy Land in 1836. From the hill where St. Paul had preached, Lambert succeeded in breaking off a piece of the rock which I took away with me. But like Wiley, who was enamored of Constantinople, Lambert found himself drawn to Rio de Janeiro, which he believed was unrivaled in beauty and grandeur. Descriptions of these regions were not universally positive, especially about the West Indies station and Gulf of Mexico. Lieutenant McKay dreaded his assignment to the region immediately upon receiving orders to USS Hornet. "I must begin to pack up," he wrote, "and make my little arrangements, not, I confess, without some foreboding, not exactly of death and yellow fever, but it's a climate I do not like." Lieutenant Pendergrast was also aware of the region's hazards, having read with much regret the accounts of the fatal consequences of yellow fever in the West India Squadron. Other officers observed the man-made dangers, such as the atrocities committed by Caribbean pirates. Others recognized the instability of Mexico and that the Mexican army was exceedingly anxious for a melee. Junior officers were also curious about naval policies and broader American politics, first engaging with one another and then through periodicals. A few months before his untimely death aboard Hornet, McKay announced that he planned to write an article on Navy policy using reports, documents, and state papers, and asked his friends still in the United States to send anything of interest in papers and magazines to him for reference. Some officers directly solicited members of Congress or those close to them. Thomas Lambert, for example, wrote at the request of the officers of the frigate Brandywine about a bill on equalizing the pay of naval officers. Members clearly listened to their concerns, as evidenced by the chairman of the Committee on Naval Affairs in 1835, informing a junior officer on the status of a bill. DuPont and his peers found themselves especially attuned to the administration, commenting that Jackson had done everything in his power to assist us. They were even aware of the appointment of officials like Amos Kendall, who was not part of the Navy, but rather served as fourth auditor of the Treasury Department, which held key accounting responsibilities for the Navy. In the 1830s, junior officers sometimes found issues so compelling that they were willing to risk retribution from their commanding officer or commander-in-chief to influence public policies. Senior officers attempted to stem this either through courts-martial proceedings or direct orders. This was the case when Commodore George W. Rogers, while commanding the Brazil Squadron in 1831-32, issued an order to all his officers that they were positively forbidden communication, either directly or through their friends, to the public prints in the United States or elsewhere, the movements or transactions that may occur in the squadron. Many naval officers married into political families, such as with the daughters of congressmen. In Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and other port cities with established American blue blood families, naval officers could identify potential spouses. Stewart, for example, met and married his wife, Delia Tudor, the Belle of Boston, a few weeks prior to deploying with Constellation in 1812. Of the following decades, Steedman recounted that Norfolk was the Garden of Eden for naval officers, given that so many had married there. The diversity and depth of topics in the correspondence of the naval officers during the 1830s suggest a growing naval intellectual community. Fortunately, this awareness did not remain isolated to private correspondence between the officers, but evolved as very public debates in the new medium of naval and other journals. Publications became more widespread in the 1830s, and, with it, greater opportunities to share ideas. Naval and other publications were integral to the reform movement among officers. Until this time, articles about the Navy in journals, particularly by serving officers, were sporadic and were usually simple accounts of naval actions and hagiographic biographical essays of early naval heroes. New military-specific publications emerged, such as the Naval Magazine, the Sailor's Magazine, and the Army and Navy Chronicle. Non-naval journals also included a growing number of articles about the Navy or by the officers themselves. The naval publications of the 1830s offered junior officers the first opportunity, under pseudonyms, to engage publicly with senior officers and citizens on topics they had begun to write about in their own private correspondence and journals. Periodicals. Whether in non-naval or Navy-specific journals, officers often wrote under pen names, a practice not strictly confined to naval officers. The British colonies and eventually the United States witnessed three generations of pseudonymous authors prior to the 1830s. Perhaps the most recognizable was a young Benjamin Franklin's use of Poor Richard. Later, during the debates surrounding the ratification of the Constitution in 1787 and 1788, the Federalist Papers had a collection of authors writing under the pen name Publius and Aristides. Cato, Sentinel, and Brutus wrote the Anti-Federalist Papers. The contentious nature of the constitutional debates warranted the use of pen names, which protected the author's privacy, but also focused the debates on the message rather than the messengers. The same was true of the public naval debates of the 1830s. In a variety of journals, essays appeared by authors using only a letter, C, D, M, and X. Others chose names or phrases such as Coquille, Neptune, Candor, and A Friend of the Navy. Publishing under their own names would have proven detrimental to their careers, and the public would have dismissed their concepts as those of inexperienced junior officers who lacked the maturity of the elder captains. As articles were written anonymously, the public focused on the content and the messages rather than potentially critiquing a known author and their motivation. Thus, they could gain a wider audience. Pseudonames were an effective means of challenging conventional thinking, but not all officers agreed with the method. One officer wrote of the odious system of anonymous communications. Fear of power originated it. Fear of detection has continued it. In the warfare of anonymous communications, we pierce the mask without thought of the wound we inflict on him who it conceals, but shelters not. By contrast, it took until 1912 before the Royal Navy found an anonymous forum of debate with the Naval Review. Like the British United Service Journal, 1829-41, professional magazines emerged in the 1830s to provide a greater awareness for both military services, with some focusing strictly on the Navy. All played a role in initially advancing naval thought. The first superintendent of the Naval Academy, Franklin Buchanan, thought the military and naval magazine so important that he recommended to Secretary of the Navy, George Bancroft, that it become part of the Naval School Library. Its editor, Benjamin Homans, must have known that officers were keeping private journals and issued a call for stories and anecdotes of their piquant adventures. In the inaugural issue, one officer wrote of the brotherhood of the two services and hoped that officers would help make the magazines the repository of American talent and the altar on which all our literary oblations shall be offered. The magazine survived only 3 years. Homans attempted a similar format, but as a weekly periodical in 1835, that completed its run in 1842. It was, as he wrote in the inaugural issue, a means of obtaining information that will be highly valuable to the officer and to the citizen. The Sailor's Magazine and Naval Journal primarily found a civil maritime audience. It, too, recognized the growing abundance of materials for such a periodical. The mine, wrote the editor in August 1829, has, in fact, but just begun to be opened. Of the new periodicals, the most important was the Naval Magazine, the publication of the Naval Lyceum, whose purpose was to solicit from all fellow officers such original papers, on all subjects, directly or collaterally, connected with the elucidation and diffusion of nautical and general science and professional knowledge. The Naval Magazine found the perfect editor with Reverend Charles S. Stewart, no relation to Commodore Charles Stewart, a Navy chaplain, missionary, and well-known diarist who had published his journals about his round-the-world travels aboard Navy ships. Although it was a short-lived periodical, the magazine served as a catalyst for a budding movement seeking to institute a number of reforms and technological advances in the Navy. The Naval Lyceum specifically aimed at stimulating its members intellectually and exciting the esprit de corps of the service. Its journal was a natural extension of that intent. It provided the public forum for the next generation of naval officers. Junior officers saw opportunities for naval evolution in terms of personnel reform, platform innovation, and policy changes. The journals provided them the outlet for their frustration and desperation to ensure that conventional thinking did not impede that change. The pseudonymous Sinclair wrote, "The spirit of the times and the necessities of the Navy loudly declare that change is requisite. We cannot remain as we are, for things are fast tending to that point, when the prospects of a vast majority of the officers of our Navy will be desperate in the extreme." The periodicals offered a variety of essays. These included biographical essays, articles on emerging technologies, travel notes about the ports and countries the officers visited, assessments of foreign naval capabilities, naval policies, and ideas about how to improve the Navy. Some of the topics were extremely contentious, particularly when senior officers weighed in on the debate. These debates were not confined to the pages of the military periodicals. The newspaper, Baltimore American, for example, noted the ongoing discussion in the Army and Navy Chronicle about the creation of the grade of admiral in the Navy. The most common theme involved steam power, naval ranks, a naval school, and other navies and countries. Just as with their letters, junior officers wrote articles for the journals, sharing their experiences and outward-looking views on other countries and navies. Although the preceding generation of naval officers had traveled the globe, they published a few articles, especially since the various media were minimal. The Analectic Magazine, 1813-20, was the only relevant medium. This magazine included some American stories and biographies of naval officers, but most essays were reprints from British periodicals. The articles in the 1830s, by contrast, offer a view into the maturity of the junior officers because of how they observed the world and the trends and challenges they offered. Officers began to think strategically. The Military and Naval magazine, for example, included a review of Carl von Clausewitz on war. Young officers developed a more nuanced and progressive understanding of naval strategy and warfighting. Author D. wrote, "In peace, prepare for war, is the principle upon which our Navy has been sustained." One journal reprinted Charles Dupin's Naval Force of Great Britain, in which he wrote, "The absolute force of navies ought to not be measured by the number killed and wounded in combats between the French and British navies." Although the United States had been at peace with Britain for more than a decade, young officers continued to view the empire as the greatest threat, but also as one from which they could continue to learn. The same was true of the French. Other issues included a translation of the article, "Navy Tactics for the French Navy," an article about the size, composition, and strength of the French and other navies, and "Improvements in Shipbuilding," about British ships. In a different case, an anonymous lieutenant discussed the conflict he saw in Ecuador, its causes, and the failures of its leadership. Officers in the 1830s began to discuss options for naval schooling. One anonymous junior officer admitted that this subject had been on his mind throughout his naval service and offered his essay with the specific intent that the Department of the Navy consider it for petty officers. Petty officers had served on U.S. Navy ships, but they did not have a uniform or insignia until 1841. In addition, their ship's captain appointed them, and thus they served only while the captain was on board. A school on a ship educated apprentices aged 13 to 15 years old. The Navy, a junior officer argued, will soon become popular with that class of the community we must always depend upon for seamen, and inducements should be held out to them to remain in the service after they have served their apprenticeship. This proposal represented a significant shift. It was, however, the Naval School for Officers that captured the imagination of the authors. A naval school represented an absolute necessity to properly teach science. Moreover, schools at sea were not conducive to learning. A place cannot well be found more unfavorable to habits of close application than a man of war. In this new age, specialized professors of the sciences were a major requirement, and it would be costly to have one or more on ships. Rather, they ought to be centrally located on shore at an academy. The Naval School should rest on the example of the experience of the Military Academy at West Point. If it be proper to fit men for military command at home, it is certainly not less so to prepare for the naval profession those who are to represent our country in distant climes. A naval academy could also serve to vet applicants and candidates. The first examination for admission, wrote A.S., likely Alexander Slidell Mackenzie, would reject many applicants, and the subsequent years of probation would winnow away all the chaff, or the incorrigibly stupid, all the vicious, all the insubordinate. A.S. also suggested a schoolship for midshipmen. By coincidence, just 5 years later, Mackenzie commanded USS Summers. Without a trial, Mackenzie executed a shipman, the son of the sitting Secretary of War, and two sailors for suspected intent to mutiny. His heavy-handed and, arguably, illegal action in responding to growing evidence aboard was one of the factors that contributed to the creation in 1845 of the Permanent Naval Academy, which could teach officers about ethics, among other courses for the naval profession. No issue was as contentious in the 1830s military journals as the creation of the rank of admiral. John Paul Jones had first proposed the rank of admiral during the American Revolution, in the hope of being named so himself. Absent that opportunity, Jones pursued a flag officer billet and served in the Russian Navy. 50 years later, the Navy was full of senior captains. By 1835, the average length of service for captains was 33.2 years. Their average time and grade was 14.7 years. Lieutenants faced a similar seniority problem. Without the retirement of captains, and with no rank between captain and lieutenant, lieutenants might wait decades for a promotion. Junior officers vocalized their objection to the current system through the military journals. They argued that the Navy ought to dismiss such officers from the service if they could not perform their duties because of age or disability. Moreover, the Navy should terminate commissions based on political influence. Ship command, based only on years in service, should rest on intelligence, professional skills, and habits. Instead of admirals, they presently suggested a new ranking structure of commanders, lieutenant commanders, lieutenants, second lieutenants, and midshipmen, a structure that became the standard later in the 19th century and largely continues in the 21st century U.S. Navy. The proponents of the rank of admiral were haphazard in their zeal. "Let Congress create as many admirals," Sinclair wrote, "as in their wisdom they may deem necessary." Alexander Slidell Mackenzie stated unequivocally that the Navy needs admirals, not merely as a stimulant and reward for faithful service, but as an all-important element of discipline. He recommended 1 admiral, 4 vice admirals, and 10 rear admirals, 15 total for a Navy with barely double that number of ships. Proponents used the arguments of discipline, but it was far more about prestige manifested by more senior ranks. Such a formidable Navy required more than a captain to command it. Sea lamented that if the ship of the line Pennsylvania, which at 120 guns was one of the largest in the world, go abroad with a pendant at her masthead, let her be the first to show the flag of an American admiral. The younger officers suggested that the editors tended too much to ingratiate with the captains in the matter of admirals, to which the interests of the younger officers are opposed, and the creation of them is only advocated by the older captains and their friends. It was not the last time in U.S. history that junior officers believed publications were the tools of the senior officers. Concepts promoted by naval officers were insufficient to effect change. Other naval officers became aware of the ideas, as did policymakers. However, elected officials required a greater inducement for action. That could only come from constituents, and constituents are influenced by popular culture. In the 1830s, the most common popular medium, literature, promulgated ideas in popular culture. Literary figures from the period, such as James Fenimore Cooper, Richard Henry Dana, and the entire Knickerbocker Group, Washington Irving, James K. Paulding, etc., shared a passion for the maritime and naval environments. They provided a unique tie between the Navy and its vision that the broader, increasingly literate American public articulated and popularized. This was the first period of truly unique American writing that appealed not only to a domestic audience, but a foreign market clamoring for anything new from the former colonies. The New American Literary Collective had its genesis during the War of 1812 with the Analectic Magazine, published from 1813 to 1820. Comprised mostly of newspaper articles collected from the United States and Britain, Irving edited during the war. 2 decades later, he became one of the most popular literary figures in America and served in the Jackson administration. He was an editor when Francis Scott Key published The Defense of Fort McHenry, which was later set to music as the Star-Spangled Banner, later America's national anthem. Irving's personal friendships with naval officers like Stephen Decatur influenced his own biographical sketches of war heroes, James Lawrence, Oliver Hazard Perry, and David Porter, and produced the most sophisticated naval writing of the war. Author James Kirk Paulding thought the essays in the Analectic so important for officers that he recommended to Secretary of the Navy, Samuel Southard, that he include them in the library of every ship. Journals that were not Navy-centric were just as important as their maritime counterparts, since they broadened the potential readership from those who were in or cared about the Navy to those who should care about it. These journals were part literary and part news with some biographical sketches. Just as the American art world experienced in its own distinctiveness when the Hudson River School in the 1820s and 1830s, a similar group emerged from Tarrytown, New York. The Knickerbocker Group had ties to the Navy and advocated its role, even subtly, in national security as well as the importance of a maritime component of American society. The Knickerbocker Magazine, founded in 1833, included some of the most prominent literary figures of the period. James Kirk Paulding later served as Secretary of the Navy under Martin Van Buren. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's namesake was a naval officer killed at Tripoli. Oliver Wendell Holmes' poem, Old Ironsides, would later save the USS Constitution from being broken up. James Fenimore Cooper had served as midshipman prior to his literary career. In addition to penning the first history of the Navy, he also wrote a series of articles on Navy policies in the 1830s. The Knickerbocker published a piece by Jeremiah Reynolds titled Mocha Dick, The White Whale of the Pacific, which became the foundation for Herman Melville's most famous book, Moby Dick. The Southern Literary Messenger, founded in 1834 in Richmond, Virginia, and edited by Edgar Allan Poe, provided a favorable review of Lieutenant Matthew Murray's book on navigation. It included essays about the Navy's first round-the-world voyages and an extensive series on naval policies by junior officers. The relationships between naval officers and literary figures continued through the next decade, such as the growing connections between James Fenimore Cooper and Matthew C. Perry. Another member, Washington Irving, was the son of a Royal Navy petty officer. In 1828, he published The Life and Voyages of Christopher Columbus and followed it up with a volume in 1831 on the voyages and discoveries of the companions of Columbus. Irving was an early critic of the militia and volunteer units as miserable military quacks during the War of 1812, but recognized the value of the Navy. "We are all alive at present," he wrote in late 1812, "in consequence of our naval victories. God knows they were well timed to save the national spirit from being depressed." While traveling in England in the 1830s, he maintained his relationships with naval officers. For example, his nephew, Edgar Irving, a former midshipman and later Marine Corps officer, was a member of the Naval Lyceum. While trying to help Alexander Slidell Mackenzie publish one of his own works, when Irving left the United States for Europe after the War of 1812, The country was largely rural, with a capital burned by the British in retaliation for the attack on York, now Toronto, Canada. He returned 17 years later to a nation of railroads, steamboats, and a populist president. Writing to his friend Alexander Hill Everett in 1829, Irving averred that he had no political ambition after being offered the position of Secretary of Legation in London. He planned on being as clear as possible from party politics. Whether it was the eventual allure of politics or the need for steady income, he finally accepted the position as Secretary of Legation. He was soon criticizing the cabinet and the media in support of Jackson, his benefactor. When he was in Washington, the president received him in the White House. It was the first of several recorded meetings between the author and the president. James Kirk Paulding and Congressman Governor Kimball later recommended Irving for the position of Secretary of the Navy, but Irving refused. "I shrink from the harsh cares and turmoils of public and political life," he wrote, "and feel that I am too restive to endure the bitter hostility and the slanders and misrepresentations of the press, which beset high station in this country." Other members of the Knickerbockers were less involved, but nevertheless had ties to the Navy and to maritime industry. William Cullen Bryant, for example, a poet and editor-in-chief of the New York Evening Post from 1828 to 1878, was a close friend of Richard Henry Dana, author of 2 Years Before the Mast. Others had similar ties to Dana, Nathaniel Hawthorne and Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Paulding was already an established figure in the Navy, as well as for his literary work. The son of a ship captain, he served as secretary for the Navy's Board of Navy Commissioners, 1815 through 23, and as a Navy agent in New York City, 1824 through 38. In the latter capacity, he identified shortcomings in the libraries of Navy ships. Most of the books he recommended were published within the previous 3 years. They covered naval gunnery, naval architecture, atlases, and other practical books. Included in his recommendation was Irving's Life and Voyages of Columbus, because he knew of no work worthier of being placed in the hands of Navy officers, or one more calculated to inspire them with noble ambition. Throughout his tenure in New York, Paulding wrote in private and public of his views on the concepts of self-government, monopolies, and the works of other authors, like the first volume of U.S. History by George Bancroft, who, like Paulding, later served as Secretary of the Navy. Heavy on the minds of these literary figures was the threat of war with either France or Britain. "Everybody here is talking of war," Paulding wrote to Martin Van Buren, "and my old friend Fenimore Cooper is in a most belligerent attitude every day in Wall Street." Paulding recognized in France's case that it was not seizing ships and impressing seamen as with the British 2 decades before. In 1838, President Martin Van Buren named Paulding Secretary of the Navy. Irving often wrote him for favors, recommending the son of a New York politician for the position of artist for the South Seas Exploration Expedition, suggesting officers for promotion, and requesting a commission for his brother. Paulding's frustrations with the administrative and political components of the position could not have been clear when he wrote to Irving that "the members of Congress, too, have got a habit of eternally interfering with appointments and destinations." Yet, Paulding was not adverse to supporting his fellow Knickerbockers. As Secretary of the Navy, as a brother scribe, he directed James Fenimore Cooper's naval fiction and history books to be added to the libraries of the public ships, "for I know not where our young officers can find better practical illustrations of seamanship than they contain." Although Paulding became a Navy secretary, no Knickerbocker had as much knowledge or impact on the Navy as James Fenimore Cooper. A midshipman before the War of 1812, Cooper formed lifelong relationships with the naval officers with whom he had served, such as William Shubrick, Isaac Chauncey, and Richard Dale. In the pages of the Naval Magazine, Cooper expressed his thoughts on ranks, manning, and ships. He favored increasing taxes to increase the size of the Navy by 50%. His personal correspondence with Shubrick, specifically about the ship of the line Pennsylvania, under construction in 1836 to 1837, demonstrated an intimate knowledge of its lines and potential uses. While he continued to write fiction, including maritime theme works, Cooper set out to write the first major history of the Navy. Longtime chief clerk to the Department of the Navy, Charles W. Goldsborough, wrote the United States Naval Chronicle, 1824, a brief history through 1801. Cooper's two-volume work, by contrast, was the first American naval history book to have a unifying theme: the high character of the American naval officer. The book received mixed reviews, primarily because of his treatment of Oliver Hazard Perry and Jesse Duncan Elliott during the Battle of Lake Erie, namely, the belief that Elliott failed to engage his ship with the British, while Perry's ship bore the brunt of the enemy's gunfire. The Army and Navy Chronicle wrote that Cooper's work was a much-needed history, and that surpassed Cooper's power of nautical description. A British review criticized him for detracting from the fame of the British Navy, a task, it argued, that was clearly beyond his powers based only on loose generalities. Whether or not he was correct in his assessment or writings, Cooper's body of work, both fiction and nonfiction, was a major contribution to the public's awareness of the Navy at a period of major change. Nor was literature the only medium that enabled the public to learn about the sea services. America began to recognize its naval heritage through sculptures. The Tripoli Monument, dedicated to the dead naval personnel during the Barbary War, was erected at the Washington Navy Yard and moved to the Capitol in 1831, and then to the Naval Academy in 1860. The intent of the Tripoli Monument was to memorialize the sacrifice of the Barbary War sailors and inspire the public. The mission then changed to that of inspiring the students of a new school. Education, creating noblemen in the defense of the Republic. In 1840, more than 2 million American youth had enrolled in schools, including in the growing number of colleges. Education was part of the wave of democratization with the election of populist Andrew Jackson in 1828. It also reflected the first wave of immigration by injecting previously underschooled youth, the second revival period for American religion, and the introduction of new technologies that spurred the Industrial Revolution. These forces led to a shift in the country's approach in how to develop its youth. The same debates in the civilian sector applied to how the Navy modified its own education of officers. Education in the early Republic varied because of federalism, geography, and population. The nature of the Federalist government separated powers between national, state, and local governments. The Constitution did not include education. Therefore, it fell to state and local governments. Diversity within each state also challenged how policymakers treated education. In New York, for example, only a quarter of the state's youth were enrolled in schools. Some states required towns to build elementary schools based on population. The United States only had 5.3 million residents, including 900,000 slaves, in 1801. But its population would quadruple by 1850. Britain, by comparison, had a population of 9 million in 1801 that would double by 1850. In 1800, only 6 U.S. cities had a population of 10,000 or more. By 1830, 23 cities had 10,000 or more. Urbanized areas, especially in the Northeast, had the population and tax base to support school systems. Most midshipmen were from urban environments and consequently already had some exposure to school by the time they were commissioned. One historian notes that after 1830, a new generation of educational reformers appeared, and the tide began to turn. Massachusetts reformer Horace Mann, brother-in-law of literary figure Nathaniel Hawthorne, became the father of the Common School movement and founded the Common School Journal in 1838. Mann and other reformers believed education provided the appropriate discipline in creating responsible citizens for the Republic. The Prussian model influenced American education and its reformers more than British education, despite the latter's Anglican school establishment. The Prussian system emphasized discipline and, more importantly, certified and trained teachers. Reports on Prussian education began to reach the reformers, including Mann and his fellow Massachusetts educator, George Bancroft, who founded the U.S. Naval Academy before he served as the Secretary of the Navy. Like its Prussian model, American education found itself driven by nationalism. Common school books began to appear in the 1830s. Noah Webster, for example, designed textbooks to promote a consistent American language and a common knowledge of geography across regional boundaries. A map of the United States, often copied, dominates another common schoolbook, Rudiments of National Knowledge, presented to the youth of the United States and to inquiring foreigners. Superimposed on the map is an eagle in full flight, its head dominating New England, its wings effortlessly spreading across the Midwest and beyond the established borders, and its talons firmly planted in the region of Florida, still controlled by Spain and populated by Native American tribes. The eagle's eyes fix on the Atlantic and beyond. Was the image an accident or intentional? Perhaps it was an indication that the publishers wanted American youth to recognize that the country would continue to move west, that conflict in Florida was likely, and that it would defend its territory from European powers. In contrast, British naval education rested on the needs of empire and the idea that only a select few, primarily from the aristocratic class, would lead their ships and protect their civilization. By 1700, there were three methods of becoming a commissioned officer: as an apprentice to a senior officer, with each officer allotted a certain number; as a nominee of the admiralty; and as a rating. Like the early U.S. Navy, instructors at sea were mostly clergymen. Eventually, the British instituted schoolmasters, with 98 appointed between 1806 and 1824. But only 20 serving regularly in the fleet. By the 1830s, the Royal Navy had abolished schoolmasters. European powers established naval schools as the wars of the 17th and 18th centuries developed: France, 1682, Denmark, 1701, Russia, 1715. The French also later established the École Navale in 1830 on the ship Orion, the first of the formal naval academies. Britain had established the Portsmouth Naval Academy in 1733, but few entered it because it threatened the patronage system of the senior ranks. Arguably, the patron system in the Royal Navy largely worked. No senior officer wanted to gain a reputation for advancing less capable officers. The academy closed in 1806. 2 years later, the British founded the Royal Naval College, and a Royal Naval Academy opened from 1833 to 1837. The British would create a formal naval training school in 1815 on board HMS Britannia. The Admiralty's sentiment was no different from that of its American peers. There was a dependency on tradition and resistance to cultural and, therefore, naval education change. King William IV, the Sailor King, articulated this resistance in his comment that there was no place superior to the quarter-deck of a British man of war for the education of a gentleman. This was similar to Commodore Stewart's quote about American naval education, that the best school for the instruction of youth in the naval profession is the deck of a ship. However, the Age of Enlightenment introduced new disciplines and applications of scientific theory, particularly with the advent of steam warships and new ordnance. The U.S. Navy needed a new generation whose curiosity could harness new technologies. More importantly, the Navy needed to properly educate them to employ these technologies. The creation of West Point, for example, aimed to meet the needs of a nation desperate to defend itself from foreign incursion. Part of that need was to train engineers on warfare, such as the use of artillery or the construction of fortifications. The unique nature of the sea required that midshipmen learn their trade on the oceans during the age of sail. But as warfare and platforms evolved, the Navy and the nation required a more formal school. Books became the junior officer's primary opportunity to learn about theory and history on ships. What they read provides a glimpse into the awareness of naval history, science, nature, and politics around the world. By 1839, the Navy furnished a variety of books to ships' libraries, histories of Greece, Rome, and England, Vattel's Law of Nations, and Jacobson's Sea Laws, treaties with foreign powers, descriptions of the voyages of Columbus, Drake, Magellan, Cavendish, and the USS Potomac, and others. Midshipman Thomas Dornan wrote about some of the books available on the Falmouth. "I have been lately engaged in pursuing the lives of Collingwood and Nelson. What a different feeling you experience from reading these two works. The spirit nobly displays unshaken valor, keen diplomatical knowledge, and a mild Christian-like benevolence, and a wonderfully just estimate of human character. It should be perused by every naval officer, and would be no contemptible addition to the library of any statesman. But I felt a deep and sensible pain on reading Southey's Life of Nelson, which cannot be deemed otherwise than impartial and just. At this time, biographies of American naval officers were rare, hence the reliance on books about British officers. James Kirk Paulding made books for adoption fleet-wide in 1838. 4 years later, a formal printed list of books for ships appeared in Navy regulations. Midshipmen, however, still needed education. Shipboard schooling was a natural but inconsistent means of educating midshipmen. In 1813, schoolmasters served on ships that had at least 12 midshipmen. Until 1815, this meant only frigates, since the Navy's first ships of the line were not completed until after the war. On smaller ships, such as brigs, sloops, and schooners, the schoolmaster role was collateral duty for chaplains. By the 1820s, the Navy required basic qualifications for schoolmasters, but individual captains, not the Navy, selected the clergy that served on their ships. Consequently, their ability to teach scientific subjects remained limited, or at best inconsistent from ship to ship. In the 1830s, the Navy attempted to resolve this discrepancy. The Navy recognized that during a peacetime environment, shore-based schools could educate midshipmen more efficiently before they deployed on their ships. The Navy hired qualified instructors and based them at three major Navy yards in Boston, New York, and Norfolk. Midshipman Charles Steedman reported to the Naval School at the New York Navy Yard in 1828 under the command of Commodore Isaac Chauncey and Captain Francis Gregory. The school included 30 to 40 midshipmen, where Edward C. Ward served as professor of mathematics and Professor Moule taught Spanish and French. By Steedman's calculation, before the establishment of the Naval Academy, nearly half the midshipmen came from appointments by politicians from Virginia, Maryland, and the District of Columbia. In some cases, the Navy and the private sector attempted innovative and collaborative measures. For example, in 1830, the Columbia College, later university, new president William Dewar offered to Commodore Isaac Chauncey schooling for the local young officers. On January 16, 1830, Dewar established a scientific and literary course open to both matriculated and non-matriculated students. The course was like those already offered by Columbia, with the exception of replacing Greek and Latin languages with modern languages. Chauncey was cautiously intrigued by the offer and wrote to Secretary of the Navy Branch, "This proposal is a liberal one, not more expensive than the Navy Yard schools. I certainly should prefer a naval school, if Congress would authorize one." Although, for unknown reasons, he found it impractical at that time, he was amenable to the possibility. Until that could happen, Duer also recommended attaching a naval officer to the college for superintending the young officers and enforcing discipline. Within a month, Chauncey identified the challenges and approved a plan for the education of naval officers. It is unknown if this collaboration between the Navy and Columbia resulted in any Navy students or graduates, although there is some evidence of at least one participant. What is known is that Duer had come far since his days as a midshipman, 3 decades before and during the Quasi-War. Threatened with a court-martial for stabbing and threatening to murder another midshipman and striking a lieutenant, Duer relied on his family to save him. His mother was Lady Catherine Duer, whose father was Lord Stirling, William Alexander, an American Revolutionary War general. She appealed to President John Adams to allow him to resign. Adams turned the matter over to Secretary of the Navy Benjamin Stoddard, who blamed the ship's captain for allowing too much wine in the wardroom. Duer resigned, attended law school, was elected to the New York State Assembly, and became a judge before assuming his role at Columbia. Few institutions, except for lyceums, were better manifestations of the Age of Enlightenment than schools, representing as they did the progress of human knowledge and mind. The Lyceum movement in the United States offered adults an opportunity to learn through public lectures as noted figures traveled the country from Lyceum to Lyceum. The first Lyceum was established in 1826 in Massachusetts. The Brooklyn Navy Yard Lyceum would serve as a lecture hall, museum, library, and post office for naval officers. In the absence of a formal national naval school, one junior officer asked in 1834, "Are we always to remain stationary, while the arts, sciences, and a general knowledge are in a course of rapid progression and diffusion?" The Navy traversed the globe, requiring, by its nature, cooperation with foreign entities for supplies. Its officers interacted with other navies, government officials, and, just as importantly, individuals with commercial interests. Thus, the Navy needed educated gentlemen to carry out the affairs of state and industry. Common schools and the naval schools were insufficient to meet that need, particularly in the areas of developing moral character. The Naval Academy, while proposed for nearly 50 years, might not have come into existence without a fundamental change in platforms and technologies, and junior officers who recognized and advocated for this change. As early as the American Revolution, John Paul Jones had recommended the foundation of a Naval Academy, or rather, a series of academies at various bases. In 1806, Captain Thomas Truxton lamented the lack of naval education, especially when it came to the more theoretical aspects of the profession. Truxton also bemoaned the lack of naval pride at the time, even in the wake of the First Barbary War, though this national attitude changed with the War of 1812. In 1815, the Board of Navy Commissioners' report also supported the creation of a naval academy. Secretary of the Navy, Southard, suggested that a naval academy would improve discipline and reduce the number of courts-martial. Supporters and opponents both invoked naval history to support their case for a naval academy. One congressman argued that it would give to all the young men in our Navy the means of becoming Decaturs and Perrys. The congressman failed to recognize that neither Decatur nor Perry were products of a naval school. A case made by one anonymous essayist who asked, "Could a Rodney, Nelson, or a Collingwood have been made in such a school? If this system is continued, shall we not in vain look for future Decaturs, Lawrences, Perrys, and McDonoughs?" The Crucible of Enlightenment, the Naval Lyceum. The nature of a navy is that the entire fleet is rarely, if ever, at shore simultaneously. Some ships are deployed, while some are in their home nation undergoing maintenance and repairs. Even ships that are ashore are scattered across different ports, assuming a nation has more than one port. During the 1830s, for example, the Navy had 7 home ports. At any given time, 1/3 to 1/2 of its ships were deployed around the globe. Thus, in the Republic of Ideas, correspondence and publications in various periodicals were important components in disseminating original and evolving concepts. These provided a valuable link among the new generation of naval officers at home and in foreign lands, but they lacked a critical element to unite them for a common cause, a home. In this case, the home became a structure and accompanying organization that enabled open-minded senior officers to encourage ideas of the junior officers. The Naval Lyceum provided that home, a crucible for naval reformers that provided legitimacy through a permanent professional organization that could advance new concepts. The Naval Lyceum was not the first attempt at a professional military organization in the United States. As the nation concluded the First Barbary War, returning officers established the United States Military Philosophical Society. Its purpose was to collect and preserve the military science from veterans of the American Revolution and share scientific knowledge about warfare. During its existence from 1806 to 1813, the Society's members included the sitting President and Secretary of War, elected officials, and Army and Navy officers. The Lyceum movement of the early 19th century sought to inform and educate adults through lectures and other public events. Massachusetts established the first Lyceum in 1826. Other Lyceums quickly followed in New England and then the Mid-Atlantic states and eventually some southern metropolitan areas. In December 1833, officers stationed at the Brooklyn Naval Yard made a public announcement about the founding of the Naval Lyceum, the purpose of which was to elevate and adorn the character of our Navy by placing within the grasp of its officers the means of acquiring professional and general information, to stimulate the members of the profession by creating a common interest in the result, to new energy in the steady and zealous pursuit of knowledge, as the grand source of moral power, and to bind yet more closely the ties which unite them, but erecting a national society. The officers advised the Board of Naval Commissioners on the establishment of the organization, in which they proposed a cabinet of natural and artificial curiosities and specimens, as well as the creation of a library, to be built with funds from membership fees. They sought to stimulate the zeal, talents, and enterprise of officers to collect and furnish specimens collected from abroad. Soon, officers and other members began donating works. Josiah Tatnall, later a senior officer in the Confederate Navy, provided a copy of the History of Naval Architecture. James Fenimore Cooper donated some of his own work. By 1835, the library consisted of 1,134 volumes, 141 European periodicals, 148 American periodicals, and 14 books of charts and maps. The Lyceum published its own periodical, the Navy Magazine, for 2 years, 1835 and 36, but other periodicals echoed this curiosity about the world. The Military and Naval Magazine issued a call to its readership. We must look for collections of antiques, of nautical surveys, for descriptions of foreign people and countries, their manners, commerce, and institutions, their climate, soul, and productions. One Mediterranean-based officer in 1836 noted as he passed Ithaca that it was the birthplace of Telemachus, of which Ulysses was king, and cited Lord Byron's works as his squadron formed north of the Peloponnese before visiting the Acropolis. Byron had, in fact, visited the USS Constitution when it was in the Mediterranean. The Naval Lyceum was soon filled by artifacts from around the globe. These included antiquities from Egypt and Greece, wood sculptures and weapons from South America and the Pacific Islands, and items from East Asia. As a result, the Lyceum became one of the first repositories in the United States a decade before the Smithsonian Institution. This inquisitiveness was an indication that the Navy and the nation were not insular. The Naval Lyceum was the foundation organization of the officers to learn about that world. The Navy's officers were outward-looking and were forming an understanding of foreign cultures, histories, and geography. It was also an indication that the Navy must evolve and take an increasing role in world affairs. One historian states that Matthew Perry was the driving force behind the Lyceum's organization and activities. While this is largely true, Perry also needed support from the new generation of naval officers, eager to challenge conventional thinking and embrace new concepts through an institution of professional learning like the Lyceum. Perry served as the first vice president, with Commodore Charles Ridgely serving as the organization's first president. The second vice president was Tunis Craven, a naval storekeeper and son-in-law of Captain Thomas Tingey, who had been the longtime commander of the Washington Navy Yard. Tingey was also a member of the Washington-based Columbian Institute for Promotion of the Arts and Sciences. The institute was responsible for the creation of the U.S. Botanical Gardens on Capitol Hill. It is possible that Perry and the other officers drew from the mission of the institute for the Lyceum. Lieutenant William C. Hudson served as the Lyceum's corresponding secretary. In 1838, he received command of Peacock and placed second in the overall command of the South Seas Exploring Expedition. In 1857, he was the first commanding officer to attempt to lay a transatlantic telegraph cable in cooperation with HMS Agamemnon, a feat they accomplished the following year. The meetings began in Perry's office at noon every Monday. The first year, the Lyceum had 88 New York resident members, 83 non-resident members, and 52 corresponding members, including four British captains, Prince Charles Bonaparte and ship designer Samuel Humphreys, son of Joshua Humphreys, who designed the first six frigates of the Navy. Honorary members included President Jackson, Martin Van Buren, former Presidents Madison and John Quincy Adams, Joseph Bonaparte, and literary figures such as Cooper and Irving. Conspicuous by their absence were some of the senior-most captains in the Navy, including Commodores James Barron and Charles Stewart. Its membership reflected the interest of the new generation of naval officers. Of the 28 officers of the USS Franklin in 1817, still on active duty in the 1830s, all were members of the Lyceum, with the exception of Stewart. Of the 267 members during its initial 6 years, the near majority were junior officers, 117 were lieutenants, and another 48 were past midshipmen. Fewer than half of the serving captains were members. Members also included 29 Navy surgeons. Non-members were welcomed as well. Ships' wardrooms were invited to meet at the Lyceum when they pulled into New York. Equally important were the numerous guests who visited the museum. The Lyceum's guestbook reveals a telling story about those whom the Lyceum's events attracted, or whom it sought guidance from, or in some cases, whom to influence. One of the first guests was Richard Russell Walden, who a few years later served as purser and Navy agent with the South Seas Exploring Expedition. The Lyceum attracted academics like Spanish professor Miguel Cabrera, mathematics professor George W. Benedict of the University of Vermont, who later helped build a telegraph company, and Professor Benjamin Silliman, the first chemistry professor at Yale University. Guests included politicians like Congressman Robert Livingston and Senator Nathaniel Talmadge, as well as British, German, Mexican, and French military officers. Naval constructor John Linthal frequented the Lyceum and was largely responsible for the ship design used through the Civil War. The Naval Lyceum's existence helped to bond the officers and interested civilians during the 1830s about naval issues. First, this afforded the first opportunity for naval officers to gather and communicate ideas with one another, since the Lyceum also served as a post office for their correspondence. Second, it provided a venue to meet others such as foreign military dignitaries, domestic Navy, Army, and revenue cutter officers, legislators, and academicians. Third, its existence led to other publications. In 1873, one of the junior officers and his son founded the U.S. Naval Institute, which would publish the magazine Proceedings and the resulting concepts of American sea power advocated by Alfred Thayer Mahon and William B. Luce, both of whom had been members of the Lyceum and Naval Institute. The same democratic wave that swept Jackson into power empowered a new generation of naval officers to challenge conventional naval authority. They were awoken by a new spirit and united by their ability to communicate with one another. In 21st century parlance, they crowdsourced their ideas, such as investigating how new technologies could be used to advance the fleet, how they might achieve a common naval education, and the U.S. Navy's expanding role for the nation. While the officers were able to disseminate their ideas among each other and in publications, another factor played a significant and necessary role in advancing their ideas. This was the first decade in which the officers could share those ideas with like-minded public figures. The nation's early literary figures were instrumental in propagating their concepts. Luminaries such as James Fenimore Cooper and others sought to appeal to and convince the nation that it had a maritime destiny. Although they wrote nonfiction, their sea-based fiction was more popular and helped ingrain a sense of America's role on the high seas. These literary figures were able to move the issues and the romance of the sea and the Navy beyond the confines and echo chamber of the Department of the Navy. They engaged the American public by conveying ideas through naval-oriented fiction, such as Joseph C. Hart's 1834 Miriam Coffin, in which he wrote that the country was informed by a strident maritime nationalism. Supremacy on the ocean is America's great national destiny. Although they had ideas, the functions had to be implemented by sympathetic policymakers who had the authority to make changes. During a unique era, no one held more power and ability to do so than the president himself and the administration he built to enable these changes.